We're in Isaiah chapter 15. We're going to try to make some tracks tonight. 13 through 23, we're looking at the judgment of the nations. It covers 10, including Jerusalem. Judgments are outlined. And as we move through, again, Isaiah continually sees through the historical circumstances to many of the things that are happening in our day. And as we read through these kind of passages, they may seem to be tedious. There's so much historical data involved, we could spend, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks moving through this judgment of the nations, and the scholars are often in some places divided over whether it's speaking of things exclusively that happened in that day, or are we looking at things that are still ahead of us. And the thing that we can see is that God is involved with history, His providence, in a remarkable way. Not only knowing everything ahead of time, but calling the shots. The bottom line is, He's God. He moves nations, the theme of Daniel. He sets up nations and governors, and He takes them down again and again. Looking at the things that we see happening in the world today, particularly in Europe, the changing of governments and so forth, God again preparing the earth for the coming of His Son. And we get to see that as we move through, how God calls the shots, how He prepares the nations, if He has to, and moves them to coincide with His own plans and purposes. And that is still happening. So let's look at chapter 15 and begins to speak of Moab, the burden of Moab. Because in the night, Ar of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Because in the night, Kir of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. He has gone up to Bajeth and to Dibon, the high places, to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo, Medeba. On all their heads shall be baldness. Every beard shall be cut off. Great wailing, mourning in Moab. In their streets they shall gird themselves with sackcloth. On tops of their houses and in their streets everyone shall howl, weeping abundantly. And Heshbon shall cry, and their voice shall be heard even unto Jahaz. Therefore the armed soldiers of Moab shall cry out. So much devastation, even the army is overwhelmed, frightened. His life shall be grievous to him, and my heart shall cry out for Moab. So here's Isaiah looking now again. In the beginning it tells us God is giving him visions. These are things somehow he's seeing. And like many of the prophets, as we read through, we find out sometimes so overwhelming that it actually drains his physical body, the things that God is revealing to him as he's seeing the things that are taking place around him. The background in this is Assyria. The northern 10 tribes have gone into apostasy. They are at odds with Judah. They were trying to make an alliance with Syria and Damascus to come down and overpower the tribe of Judah. God is judging now Syria and Ephraim, the northern tribes, using Assyria as his tool. And Assyria will move through Moab down into the Philistine country. And the Assyrians, again, were so cruel and so ruthless that whole towns would commit suicide at times when they were surrounded by the Assyrians. Rather than facing the Assyrians, you would take the lives of your children and of your wife and then your own life to keep from falling into their hands. They were so ruthless. So as Isaiah sees what happens to Moab, who is always caused Israel trouble. Moab never really the friend of Israel. He's even grieved as he sees the destruction in Moab. His heart is moved now. He cries out for Moab. His fugitives shall flee unto Zoar. Interesting, the father of Moab and Ammon was Lot. And Zoar was the place that their great-great-granddaddy had fled to so many years and years before this. Now here Moab fleeing to Zoar, one of the cities down in the plains, down by Sodom and Gomorrah. a heifer of 3 years old, for by the mounting up of Luhith with weeping shall they go it up. And in the way of Horonim they shall raise up a cry of destruction. For the waters of Nimrim shall be desolate. For the hay is withered away, the grass faileth, there is no green thing. Therefore the abundance they have gotten, that which they have laid up, shall they carry away to the brook of the willows. For the cry is gone round about the borders of Moab, the howling thereof into Igliam, and the howling thereof into Beer Elim. For the waters of Dimon shall be full of blood, and I will bring more upon Dimon lions, upon them that escape of Moab, and upon the remnant of the land. Now, one of the great purposes of this for God's people in Isaiah's day, and there are times when he says, now this will happen within 2 years, or this will take place within 3 years, or it will be 1 year before this comes to pass, is that his contemporaries would actually see prophecy being fulfilled and then realize that the message that Isaiah has for the nation of Israel, and Judah in particular, will also be fulfilled. And Isaiah is always talking about the fact that God will establish upon the throne of David that one who should come to rule. That though it looks like Judah is going to be carried away by the Assyrians, that God will keep his covenant. And one of the things that God wants to impress upon the hearts of his people even today, the church, and Israel for that matter, is that what they see taking place around them in the world is proving to them that God is the one who he says that he is, that he is the one who is maneuvering the nations, and that all the things that God has to say in regards to his people will also come to pass. And again, sometimes so hard for us to believe that God looks at us and says, you're justified, you're glorified, you're sanctified, that he loves us with an everlasting love. And we look at ourselves often in the mirror, or we look at that place in our heart that no other man knows about, and it seems so ugly, and there seem to be so many areas that we're struggling with, and just seems so slow to change in our own lives. And yet God tells us of his love, and he tells us one day that he'll blow that trumpet, and we shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye, and this corruption shall put on incorruption. Those things seem so hard to believe, but God is always one to point at his word and say, look at what I've said, look at what I've done, look how everything is falling into place, what I've already told you would happen, and so I'll fulfill all of my word upon my people. And that's one thing that God's people in the historical background here are to learn as we hear these prophecies about Moab. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing some of the names right. You probably don't either. I'll fake it. You won't know. And some of these things are written in a Hebrew poetic form, and I don't understand what they mean. And it's funny, you read the commentaries and the scholars, they all have different ideas. So we read through them. I think there are some points that where we can make application in our own lives today. And as you look at the world around us today, it should be speaking to your heart that our redemption is drawing nigh, and that you should be living in a certain way. And examining your life and your heart as we move into the 1990s. And not that we're legalists. Not that we're saved by works. We're saved by grace. But how much time is left before God brings all these things he said to pass? How much are we being good stewards over the time and the opportunities that God is setting before us? As we see God dealing with Moab, with the nations, with our neighbors, and with the countries around us, we see the things happening that God said would happen. He's going to talk about ecology when we get to chapter 19. We see what's happening in our ecology here in the States, agriculturally. We see the storms and so forth. So as we read through it, not just speaking of names and cities that we can't relate to and a background that historically is even controversial, but overall, and when we get to chapters 41 through 45, God continually says it. Aren't I the one who said it would come to pass, and I brought it to pass? Can any of your idols, any of the things that are worshipped in the world today, and there are plenty of idols, automobiles, sex, drugs, money, fame, those are all idols. We've given them new names, but they're the same gods. Man doesn't change. Technology does, but the heart of man remains the same. Can any of your idols call the shots and predict the future? And again, mankind wants to know that. Look at the ridiculous papers in the waiting line in the supermarket and the predictions. You know, I just seen something great the other day about a UFO again. And we are enamored with those things. God says, I'm the one who calls the shots. I'm the one who tells you before what will come to pass, and prove me. See if I'm not the one. So as we look at these prophecies, remember, in the historical setting, God's people were getting to see what was taking place around them and then being reminded, I am going to keep my covenant. I am going to preserve my people. I am going to bring one who will sit upon the throne of David, and so forth. And I believe today, as we look at the nations around us, God is speaking to the church and saying, we're entering into the 1990s. You see what's happening around us. You see what's happening in Europe today. And everywhere we hear, from Russia, from China, believers all over the world are saying, the coming of Christ is drawing nigh. Whether you're pre, mid, trib, doesn't matter. I'm pre-wrath, personally. But whatever you believe, we'll all be there together. And I believe God is speaking to our hearts now. So as we read through these things, there is an impression that God would put on the hearts of his people. Again, Moab, send ye the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah to the wilderness unto the mount of the daughter of Zion. Now Selah, Petra, the tribes of Moab fleeing south into the area of Edom and the rock fortress probably there of Petra, looking there. And God saying, now send your lamb to the daughter of my people. They, during David's day, Moab paid tribute to Jerusalem, to David, and they sent their lambs and their offerings. And now God is saying to Moab, look, don't flee to these countries. I've told you that Isaiah has prophesied where there will be deliverance and where there will be survivors is in Jerusalem and Judah. And that's where you should be looking. And they're fleeing south. So, for it shall be as the wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon. Take counsel, execute judgment, make thy shadow as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcast, bury not him that wandereth. Let mine outcast dwell with thee, Moab. Now we've kind of shifted gears. As you come to Revelation chapter 12, as you go to Matthew 24, and it says, when you see the desolation of abomination, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Revelation chapter 12, he gave the woman the wings of an eagle and took her to a place in the wilderness that was prepared for her. Here, as Isaiah, in a vision that God's giving him, hard for him to understand. Remember, Peter tells us that they desired to look into the things they had prophesied and didn't understand them. They were said for us. Now, as he looks at this situation with Petra and them fleeing down there, then all of a sudden he's talking to Moab. Verse 4, he kind of shifts gears. He says, let my outcast dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end, the spoiler ceases, and the oppressors are consumed out of the land. I believe, looking down to the Antichrist and so forth. And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hastening righteousness. So again, looking down to the end when Christ will come and God's covenant will be fulfilled upon Israel. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud, even of his haughtiness and of his pride and of his wrath. But his lies shall not be so. Now remember this again. Interesting, when we read in the book of Daniel, and we hear this nation will come from the south, and then this one will come from the north as we go into chapters 10 and 11 in Daniel, and then this one will come from the south again. And this, what we're actually getting is a perspective of someone standing in the middle of all these things, which is Israel. And they're looking to the ones coming from the south, ones coming from the north. But it's almost from the angel's perspective. And as we study the scripture, again, it seems to be indicate that the only piece of real estate on the face of the earth that has one of God's holy angels ruling and watching over it is the land of Israel, where Michael, again, definite article, the archangel, the only archangel, Satan, not an archangel. He's a cherubim. Gabriel's not an archangel. It doesn't say that anywhere. Only Michael's an archangel. He's the prince of Israel. And it seems like the only piece of real estate on the earth today that has one of God's holy angels abiding over it and appointed to it is the nation of Israel. Moab, Assyria, Egypt, Greece, remember, in Daniel, Persia, the prince of Persia, demonic spirits, Europe, the United States. Soon we'll see the prince of Rosh, Ezekiel 38, principality and power. All the other nations have these principalities and powers ruling over them. So as we hear of the pride of Moab, the pride of this, the pride of, we remember back to Isaiah 14 where we hear of Satan lifting himself up, the pride of his heart and so forth. As we get to Ezekiel 28, we see the king of Tyre, and then all of a sudden we switch to Satan behind the scenes and so forth. Now again, as we hear of the pride of the nations, that's why it's very hard for me to believe as I look at Eastern Europe and we see all these walls crumbling down and everybody's excited. And I don't blame them, and I pray there's peace and things work out. But I know in my heart it's going to be so short-lived. Because behind all of these movements are principalities and powers. And they're moving to bring about their ends. The destruction of the church, the destruction of the nation of Israel. Because they know Israel is a piece in time's, God's time clock. They know the church is God's tool in the earth today to bring men from darkness to light. And ultimately, behind all these political moves and all these wonderful things that seem to be going on, there's a movement to bring about some other end that's not godly, no matter how nice it looks as we look at it. So the pride of Moab, the haughtiness. Therefore shall Moab howl, for Moab every one shall howl, for the foundation of Kiriath-Eseth, shall ye mourn, surely they are stricken. For the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Shibna, and the lords of the heathen have broken down the principal plants thereof. They are come even to Jazer. There wandereth through the wilderness. Her branches are stretched out. They are gone over the sea. You know, the idea of Assyria, like stretching out its branches. Therefore, I will bewail with the weeping of Jazer, the vine of Shibna. I will water thee with my tears, O Heshbon and Eleal, for the shouting of thy summer fruits, and for thy harvest is fallen. And the gladness is taken away, the joy out of the plentiful field. And in the vineyards there shall be no singing, neither shall there be shouting. For the treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. And what they would do is they would tread the wine and so forth in the presses. They would sing these songs, and they would have these chants, depending on the nation. And there would be songs for treading out the grapes, no singing and so forth. The treaders shall tread out no wine in their presses. I have made their vintage of shouting to cease. Wherefore my bowels shall sound like a harp for Moab. Isaiah is saying that down in his gut, as he sees what's going on, it's almost like the vibration and the strumming of a harp. You may experience that, if God's given you the gift of discernment. You get around something that's just not right, a ministry that's just not right, something's wrong, and sometimes you kind of feel like that somebody's strumming in a harp down in your stomach, you know, and just those vibrations, you kind of feel upset. Isaiah says, hey, I just feel like somebody's strumming a harp down in my gut, and the strings are going, yong, 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 you know. My inward parts for Kirarish. And it shall come to pass, when it is seen that Moab is weary on the high place, that he shall come to his sanctuary to pray, but he shall not prevail, going to his idols. This is the word that the Lord has spoken concerning Moab since that time. But now the Lord hath spoken, saying, notice, within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, the glory of Moab shall be condemned, and with all the great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and feeble. So Isaiah making a remarkable statement now, saying this will take place within 3 years. So again, speaking to God's people, as they see within a 3-year period, Moab destroyed and carried away, they're going to know that the rest of what Isaiah has to say is something that should be hearkened to and listened to. Now, we turn from Moab to Syria, Damascus. The burden of Damascus, behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They shall be for flocks, which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. The cities are going to be waste and become grazing lands. Now, as we look at Damascus and Syria in this prophecy, Damascus had made an alliance with Ephraim, with the northern 10 tribes. So both of those things are going to be looked at here. The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. They shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith the Lord of hosts. And in that day, now when we hit these phrases like in that day, you take a little closer notice to what we're looking at. In that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. And it shall be as when the harvestman gathereth the grain and reapeth the ears with his arm, and it shall be as when he gathereth ears in the valley of Rephaim. Yet, there's an important word, gleaning grapes shall be left in it, as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top, this is the olives, the uppermost bough, four or five in the outmost fruitful branches thereof, saith the Lord of Israel. Now, remember in Deuteronomy we read this. It said, when you come into your fields and you reap your harvest, it's a principle in God's working, that you shouldn't go back into your field. If you've missed any of the stalks and you've left the corners of your field, you're not allowed to go back and take them. They're to be left for the poor and for the widow, for the needy in the land. That when you take your sticks and you beat your olive trees, Deuteronomy 24 tells us, that whatever sticks to the branches, what's still green, don't go back and beat it a second time, but leave that to when it comes to ripening. It's for the people. It's one of God's principles, and now he applies it to himself, leaving a remnant. He says it's like those that are in the field that leave those few stalks of grain around, and it's like those who beat the olive trees that leave a few berries in the top. God is not unjust. If he requires that from his people, he won't do any less. So even as his nation is judged and carried away, Ephraim, Israel, the northern 10 tribes, still God will leave a remnant, like the top olives that are left on the tree, and like the grain that's still left standing in the field. At that day shall a man look to his Maker. Now see, I think we're looking further in the future. And his eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. And he shall not look to the altars, the work of his hands. Neither shall respect that which his fingers have made, either the groves or the images. Now the man realizing that idolatry has betrayed him, that is foolishness. Every man will realize that one day. Philippians tells us that every knee shall bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Every man will realize that one day that all the work of his hands and any gods he served in this world are useless. Too late, though, at that time. Verse 9 says, in that day shall his strong cities... Now we're talking about the strong cities of Syria now, of Damascus. In that day shall his strong cities be as a forsaken bough and as the uppermost branch, which they left because of the children of Israel. And there shall be desolation, because thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength. Therefore shalt thou plant pleasant plants and shall set it with strange slips. It's almost like the parable when the Lord tells about planting the field and then somebody went in and sowed tares among the wheat. It says there's going to be strange slips that are planted in the field. In that day shalt thou make thy plant to grow, and in the morning shalt thou make thy seed to flourish. But the harvest shall be a heap in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. Woe to the multitude of many people. Now Assyria is also to be judged, is what it's pointing to here, which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of nations, that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, and certainly that is still ahead of us, that type of movement among the nations, where Psalm 2 says, why do the heathen rage, why do the nations imagine a vain thing, and so forth. God shall rebuke them, They shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountains before the wind, and like a rolling thing before a whirlwind. And behold, at eventide, trouble. And before the morning, he is not. Now it's making an allusion to 2 Kings chapter 19, when the angel of the Lord went into the camp of the Assyrians in the evening, and in the morning there was 185,000 of them were dead, and we're going to hit on that a few times. Certainly, they are a type of another army that will surround Jerusalem in the last days. In Revelation chapter 16, and the Lord will appear in his glory and deal with them also. This is the portion of them that spoil us, and the lot of them that rob us. Turning now to Ethiopia, who is seeking to make, historically, again, this is what's taking place. Assyria and Egypt are really the two main world powers at that time, and they're looking at a way to overthrow each other. So Ethiopia and Egypt will look to Judah, who is still surviving, to make an alliance with them so that they may have enough strength to deal with the Assyrians. Meantime, Isaiah is going around Jerusalem telling them, don't make any alliance with Egypt, with Ethiopia. Set your heart upon the Lord and trust him, because he's the one that has an answer to your problems. He's the only one that can preserve. And this attitude of, you know, cursed is the man who trusts in the arm of flesh. Now, our nation does the same thing today. We're looking to make alliances with this nation, with that nation, all these great summits, and, you know, the Star Wars program. You know, here's a way of protecting ourselves, and a whole nation again turning to their own wisdom, their own logic, their own science. And I don't think there's anything wrong with those things. God has told us to subdue the earth. I think that technology, the development of technology, should be there for the benefit of man and so forth. But of course, there's something wrong in the heart of man. When we could be taking all the military spending in the world and using it for agriculture, we would see no starvation. Instead, we're discovering how to build a missile that's so accurate that it can hit a nickel in the street on the other side of the world and have a neutron charge in it, so it blows up the people and leaves the good stuff, the buildings and the cars. Meantime, we're allocating money to save the whales. That bothers me a little bit. Something's wrong in the works. Again, allocate all the money to the neutron weapons and the whales will be safe. As soon as we're all gone, we solve that problem. The whales will be as safe as can be. But again, man turning to his wisdom now, to his understanding, to his own abilities, instead of a nation, a whole nation. I mean, what would it be like to see our president come on television and have a nationwide broadcast and say, this week, all of us, or this month, or until it changes, all of us are going to get on our knees and we're going to repent. And we're going to seek God and we're going to remember the beginning of our nation. Yeah. Never happened. Woe to the land shadowing with wings, maybe pointing to locusts, we don't know, the trouble in Ethiopia and so forth, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, that sendeth ambassadors by the sea and vessels of bulrushes upon the water, saying, go ye swift, messengers, to a nation that is scattered and peeled, speaking of Israel and Judah, to a people terrible from their beginning hitherto until now, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled, seeking an alliance with Judah. All ye inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, see ye, when he lifteth up an ensign on the mountains, and when he bloweth a trumpet, hear ye. For so the Lord said unto me, I will take my rest. I will consider in my dwelling place like a clear heat upon the herbs, and like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the bud is perfect, when it's just budding, and the sour grape is ripening, hasn't come to fruition yet, it's still ripening in the flower, he shall both cut off the sprigs with the pruning hooks and take away and cut down the branches. So the Lord is basically saying, look, don't make an alliance with Ethiopia. You know, I'm just relaxing in my dwelling place. And I'm watching the whole scene here with the nations. Almost like somebody watches the heat on the herbs and watches the grass wither. God says, I'm watching from my dwelling place and I see everything that's happening. And prematurely, before it's expected, in some surprising way, like when the grape is still ripening and hasn't come to fruition yet, when the flower is still forming, then, before the harvest, you might think where the harvest should be, I'm gonna put in the sickle and the scythe and so forth, I'm gonna reap. And again, pointing to 2 Kings 19, they shall be left together unto the fowls of the mountains and to the beast of the earth. And the fowls shall summer upon them, and all the beasts of the earth shall winter upon them. Now again, I think pointing all the way down to the end of that great feast in Revelation 19. And in that time shall the present be brought unto the Lord of hosts from a people's Lord of hosts of a people scattered and peeled, from a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden underfoot, whose land the rivers have spoiled, to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion, Jerusalem, pointing to the millennium. In that day, the gifts, the nations will bring their gifts, the Feast of Tabernacles every year to the Lord. And now, if you've read some of these strange books that try to take this particular verse and say what this verse is saying is that the Ark of the Covenant is really hidden in Ethiopia, and what it means here in this chapter speaking to Ethiopia is that one day they're going to bring the Ark of the Covenant out of this place where it's hidden in Ethiopia, and they go in the Haile Selassie and all that stuff, and they're going to bring it to Jerusalem. You know, who the heck knows? I mean, how you could come up with that out of that, I'm not particularly sure. And as far as I'm concerned, if they bring the Ark of the Covenant tomorrow from Ethiopia, that's fine with me. I mean, the faster this whole thing comes down, the better. But there's also tradition that Jeremiah hid it over somewhere in the area of Pisgah, and that he plastered over it in a cave there. So that might turn up when Ezekiel 38 and 39. It will be interesting there. As Russia invades the Mideast, it says every wall shall fall to the ground, and that God will be sanctified in the eyes of many nations, and Israel will be awakened again as their God arises for the first time in 2,000 years. Be a nice present right on that victory for the cave to fall open and have the Ark of the Covenant. And also, on the Arch of Titus in Rome, there is a carving there of the menorah, the seven-branch candlestick like we have up here, of the table of showbread, and of another object that's partly broken off. And some feel that Titus, when he brought back his spoils from Jerusalem in 70 A.D., brought the Ark of the Covenant, the table of showbread, and the seven-branch menorah from Jerusalem. In 550, I believe, A.D., the menorah and the table of showbread were given back to what was just termed the Church of Jerusalem at that point in time. And shortly after that, the Turks conquered Jerusalem and carried the menorah and the table of showbread off. But that other object was never given. And, of course, the Roman Catholic Church does not recognize Israel's right to exist. So they're not, if it's in the basement of, who knows what's in the basement of the Vatican, they're not going to pull it out and blow the dust off it today and give it back. But again, Jean-Marie Lustiger, the Cardinal of Paris, who's in line to be the next pope, born a Jew, his name is Aaron Lustiger. We may see a Jewish pope in there in the not-too-distant future. And the head of East Germany, who's just been appointed now, Geisy, his last name is. His father was involved with the Communist Party for years. Roger Geisy, I think, is Jewish. And he's supposed to be a tremendous leader. So I could see that. That's fine with me, too. But to pull that much out of here, in that time shall the present be brought unto the Lord of hosts, is basically, they pull it all out of there. I can dream up better things than that. Now, Egypt, the burden of Egypt. Behold, the Lord rideth upon a swift cloud. And when you hear about the Lord riding upon the clouds, it's time to wake up. Behold, he cometh with clouds. Henceforth you shall see me no more, he says to the Pharisees, until you see me coming to the right hand of power and glory with the clouds of heaven and so forth. Isaiah is thinking he's looking at some remarkable things now in his vision. The Lord rideth upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence, and the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians. They shall fight everyone against his brother, everyone against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. Civil war, bringing into the land, often what God uses to judge. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I will destroy the counsel thereof, and they shall seek to the idols, and to the charmers, and to them that have familiar spirits, and to wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord and a fierce king. I think maybe looking to Daniel 7 and Rev 13 again. To rule over them, saith the Lord of hosts. Now again, the nations looking to their own charmers. Interesting. The Soviets are very big on this, spending money on extrasensory perception, mental telepathy. In fact, they're having meetings over there where some of these guys who are supposedly tapping into these realms, people are getting healed, throwing their crutches away, and people are coming by the thousands to some of these wizards and mediums that are paid by the state now. Now, of course, we're Marxists. We don't believe God is real, but, you know, we do have our sorcerers, wizards, and mediums. The United States, oftentimes the police force, will employ someone with extrasensory perception, supposedly, to help them solve a case. Time life books, you know. Woo! You can see that anytime you want, you know. The Lord says, you guys are turning the wrong way. The waters, verse 5, shall fail from the sea. Speaking of the Nile Delta, and the river shall be wasted and dried up. Speaking of the Nile River and then the sea, the Delta area. And they shall turn the rivers far away, and the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up. The reeds and the flags shall wither. The paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither and be driven away and be no more. The fishers also shall mourn, and all they that cast angle into the brooks, that use a fishing hook, shall lament, and they that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. Moreover, they that work in fine flax, they that weave network, shall be confounded. And any of those who made baskets and things out of the flax and the reeds that grew along the river, their whole industry is going to be gone because they're all going to dry up. They shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for their fish. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools, and the counsel of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise and the son of ancient kings? Now, as we do go through this, there are many that point to the Aswan Dam. I think that is legitimate in the sense that God again has spoken to the wisdom of the Egyptians as they have harassed Israel since 1948. The lower dam, the Aswan Dam, I believe, complete around 1905, but the upper, the high dam, 360-some foot high and 2,100 foot across, a pretty remarkable structure. Began functioning in 1968, completed in 1970, and they hoped to reclaim in the lower Nile Delta, which is actually upper, if you know, they're on the bottom side of the ball, expected to claim between 500,000 and 1,000,000 acres and turn it into farmland. And what actually happened at that point in time was because so much water stopped flowing to the upper Nile, which is really the lower Nile, if you understand, going from the bottom up, that they lost over 1,000,000 square acres to salt water. The brackish water came in. All of the reeds and the flax and everything began to die. The fish who were in the salt, primarily the fresh water and the brackish water, because the silt and the nutrients and stuff stopped washing down. Then the life cycle was broken. The ecology, the smaller organisms they fed on died off, and all the fish in that whole area died, and thousands of people were driven into Cairo. This is a report that was done since 1970. We're trying to get a hold of it now. Number S3448, the congressional report. That's the file number. We have to find the year and month. They're not very cooperative. They want to bother to look it up on a computer for us, you know. So we have to find out their information so they'll send us the file. But it reports on an ecological problem in California and then another ecological problem in the States. And then it does a whole thing on the problems of the Aswan Dam. And it's almost like reading Isaiah. More than that, the whole area has been infested with these snails that have this little this blood organism, and thousands have died, and they say thousands of thousands will die from it. So again, I believe God is saying to Egypt, where is all of your wisdom? Where's all of your brilliance? There's even been talk of blowing the Aswan Dam up. Probably in Isaiah's day, looking to a drought that would bring about many of the same ecological effects. But today, certainly, the Aswan Dam fits in here in a remarkable, remarkable way. Where are they, all the wise men? Verse 12. Where are thy wise men? Let them tell thee now, and let them know what the Lord of hosts hath purposed upon Egypt. The princes of Zoan are become fools, and the princes of Naph are deceived. And they have also seduced Egypt, even they that are the stay of the tribes thereof. The Lord hath mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggereth in his vomit. Isn't it interesting that God can take a nation, and when he wants to stir in a different mind, a different spirit, a different attitude into the whole nation, to make the whole nation stagger like a drunken man falling in his own vomit? I pray that that isn't happening to us. It sure seems like it is, as I look at the news, and I look at the problems in our society. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt which the head or the tail or the branch of the rush may do. Now, in that day shall Egypt be like unto women, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he shakes over it. There's a day coming when Israel is going to be in, Egypt will be in terror. And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. And everyone that maketh mention thereof shall be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts, which he has determined against it. So, hey, there's a day coming, and we haven't seen that yet, when the surrounding nations, Egypt in particular here, will have fear and awe in their hearts as they talk about the land of Judah and Israel because of the things the Lord has purposed upon it. And again, Zechariah chapters 10 and 11, Malachi chapter 3 verse 4 speaks of that day when Israel will be God's instrument in the earth, and all the other nations will stand in awe of Israel. So looking to the far again. In that day shall five cities in the land of Egypt speak the language of Canaan and swear to the Lord of hosts. Now certainly we're coming to the millennium now, when the Lord has set up his reign upon the earth. These things have not taken place. And swear to the Lord of hosts, one shall be called the city of destruction, probably the city of the sun, speaking of Hylopolis, the idea that the Lord will be worshipped there. In that day shall there be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. So as you come to the land of Egypt in that day, and it's remarkable because largely Muslim today, and if you tune in a little bit to what is happening in that part of the world as the Sunni and the Shiites are in disagreement with how to relate to the West and certain things, and really the Shiite Muslims offering to many Egyptians a better lifestyle, better care for their people, for their but the strong emphasis on Islam. There was a documentary on Channel 12. It was great. It was called The Sword of Islam. It was done well, and it goes into all the different factions and sects. But to convert someone in certain Islamic communities today to Christianity carries a death sentence to go and be a missionary and to cause conversion, not only for the one that converts. He may go home and tell his parents he's just converted to Christianity, may get his head lopped off right in the living room, but for the one who's doing the converting, often a death sentence upon him. But there is a day, you know, this is a remarkable thing, there's a day when the Palestinians and the Egyptians and the Syrians and all those in Lebanon and the Russians and those in Libya and Saudi Arabia, in Iran, in Iraq, when all the nations will come up and worship the same God and pray together. He's got a much better plan than we do. And Egypt shall put up an altar, probably a memorial. Remember when the Reuben, Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh built an altar on their side of the Jordan, and the other tribes came and wanted to kill them right away. I said, no, it's just to remind us. Probably not an altar to where they will shed blood. I believe that will happen in Jerusalem. But an altar of memorial and a pillar at the border of the land saying, this is Egypt, we worship Jehovah. That's going to be a strange landmark in the land of Egypt. And it shall be for a sign, verse 20, for a witness unto the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. And they shall cry unto the Lord because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. And the Lord shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. Yea, they shall vow a vow unto the Lord and perform it. And the Lord shall smite Egypt, he shall smite the heel of it, and they shall return. Notice, he's going to smite it, and then they shall return to the Lord, God's purpose and judgment, to turn our hearts to him. And he shall be entreated of them, and shall heal them. So one of the reasons when you walk away from the Lord and you compromise in your walk and you live in rebellion, when the big thumb comes down on you and you find yourself wandering miserably in the cloud, wondering what in the world the Lord is doing in your life, he's put the big thumb on you. You're in rebellion. His chastening comes so that your heart will turn back, that you will entreat him. He will receive your entreaty, draw you back to himself and heal you. Talks all in the Old Testament about healing the backslider. If you're backslidden tonight, you look at the days we're living in, I encourage you, turn your heart to him, pour it out before him. He'll take you in his arms, he'll heal you, bring you back to himself. Broken and a contrite spirit is always acceptable to the Lord. Verses 23 to the end of the chapter speak of the day that Egypt and Assyria and Israel will worship together. In that day shall there be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria. And the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. And the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land. So in the middle, you know, in Isaiah's day, his people probably could not believe what they were hearing, because Assyria and Egypt were at odds trying to figure out how to get over on each other. Israel was the place in the middle. It always got trampled as everybody went back and forth. And he's saying there's a day coming, man, when there's going to be a highway from Assyria to Egypt so they can go back and forth and be friends with each other and stop by Jerusalem on the way, and we'll all worship together. And that day Israel will be the third party in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people. Man, oh man. The grace and the love of Jesus Christ blow my mind. Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. So, a remarkable day, looking forward to. This is a short one. In the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod with Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him. Tartan, probably the term of his position, and fought against Ashdod and took it. The same time spake the Lord by Isaiah, the son of Amos, saying, Go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins, and put off thy shoe from thy foot. And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. So for 3 years, Isaiah walks around naked and barefoot. Now, to put your mind at ease, the Hebrew idiom here for naked means he put his outer garment off, and he still had a loincloth wrapped around him, but he put off his sackcloth, his outer garments, walked around and is basically in his underwear and barefoot. But that was the garment of a slave in Isaiah's day. He walked around girded like a common slave who had no rights, because the message he's going to be communicating now to Judah, to Jerusalem, is don't make an alliance with Ethiopia, with Egypt, because the Assyrians are going to overwhelm them. And Egypt and Ethiopia will be carried away as slaves. And now Isaiah to walk around for three, you know, Ezekiel had to do some stranger things, you know. But Isaiah did some strange things too. Man, imagine what your foot would be like after walking around for 3 years. Not a shoe. And the Lord said, like as my servant Isaiah hath walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and a wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians prisoners and the Ethiopians captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. And they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation. Now this is Judah, will be ashamed as they hear what's taking place, and of Egypt, their glory. So the Lord, you know, cursed is the man that trusts in the arm of the flesh. Those of you in the government in Judah that want to make some alliance with Ethiopia and with Egypt, and you think that will solve your problems, who have not turned your heart to me, you're going to be ashamed when you see how this whole thing pans out. You're going to be embarrassed when you see what you trusted in really turns out to be. And of course, that's the same for us tonight. You know, in my own life, so many times when I'm running dry or I find myself feeling empty, and I strive, I make an alliance with things around me in my life, try to, you know, I get frazzled, or I want to calm myself down, or if I only had some of this, and I need this, and if I work this, and really what I need to do then is just get back to my simple relationship with Jesus Christ and get into His presence and spend time with Him, and it seems like all the other nonsense goes away and retreats. And then you realize how all these other things you thought would make you happy, how foolish they really are when they're set up as a god. And remember, he said, I'll have no other gods before me. And again, that word before means in my presence. I'll have no other gods in my presence as I look at you. It doesn't mean before me in line, like I'll be number one god and then your car can be number two god. He won't have any number two gods in his presence, or any number three gods in his presence. There's no, okay, God, I'll serve you first, but this thing too. No, I'll have no other gods in my presence. Not a number two god, a number three god, a number four god. And he says, Judah, the day's coming when you're going to look at where you thought there might be strength and help at the neglect of me and the truth, and you're going to be ashamed, you're going to be embarrassed. The inhabitant of this isle shall say in that day, Behold, such is our expectation. Whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria? Where shall we go, and how shall we escape? So, that's as far as we can get tonight. Me and I wanted to get through chapter 23. Read ahead, because at the end of chapter 23, we come with the kind of to the end of God outlining what's taking place in the nations around Judah. And chapter 24 begins with a broader view of God's judgment of the world and His wrath and so forth. So we move into some real interesting territory. Be reading ahead.